This is the Age of Discovery podcast. I'm Adrian Smith, and this is episode 7. This episode is my interview with Jerry Coyne, a professor in the Ecology and Evolution Department at the University of Chicago. Jerry is well known for his research on the evolutionary genetics of speciation in Drosophila. His 2004 book, Speciation, which he co-authored with Alan Orr, is a classic in the field. Jerry has also been very successful at writing for a popular audience with his 2009 book, Why Evolution is True, and its companion website. I met with Jerry in his office at the University of Chicago. We talked about religion and science, and he shared some great stories about his days as a student. My thanks to Jerry for talking to me and sharing his stories. Let's go straight into the interview. I'm a biologist. I'm a research biologist, a postdoc. And I actually grew up in a very religious family, but I'm no longer at all religious. Mm-hmm. But just to demonstrate, I brought a book from my childhood called The Great Dinosaur Mystery in the Bible. It has illustrations of an elephant and a hippo in the same field as a dinosaur.
There's no human riding on one, though, is there?
Yeah. Well, no, there's humans admiring them from afar in the field.
Well, I'll take that as credentials of a fundamentalist past.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Baptist is what it was. So all throughout my upbringing, science was always at odds with and evolution was always at odds with religion. Religion always trumped evolution. And sort of these books and sort of the messages that I heard made sort of scientists and evolutionary biologists out to be sort of the bad guys, covering up stuff, having an anti sort of God, anti-religion agenda. And then once I go through grad school, and when in the midst of grad school, when we have to teach, you know, undergrad biology students about sort of the evidence for evolution versus creationism, we were sort of given the accommodationist stance based on like what the National Academy put out in their science creationism and evolution thing about those are two different ways of thinking. They don't overlap at all. There's no conflict. And I know you totally disagree with accommodationism. So I just wonder what, from your standpoint, sort of what do you think should be sort of the National Academy's stand, or just in general sort of evolutionary biologists' stand?
Well, I've made this clear in a lot of the writings on my website, and also in I published an article on evolution in 2012 where I proposed what I think should be done, and basically it is the stance of the society of which I was president then, the Society for the Study of Evolution. If you look at their statement on the teaching of evolution on their website, it doesn't say a word about religion. It just says evolution should be taught because it's the going theory of the development and diversity of life, and that's it. I mean, it should be taught because it's scientifically true. There's nothing in there about, and of course, it need not conflict with the religion and things like that. So my view is that when you're teaching science, you stay away from religion. You don't promulgate atheism for the students. You don't promulgate religion to the students. And above all, you don't tell the students, as you said, that religion and science are completely compatible, because that's a theological stance. I mean, as you know from your childhood, not everybody feels that religion and science are compatible. I mean, there's huge swaths of the American public, almost half, that are creationists. And so for them, that compatibility doesn't exist. So my view is to stay away from religion. And I do that when I teach. I mean, the only religion I ever mention in my class here, and I could mention it because this is a private university, there's no First Amendment rights here, but it's not wise to do that. The only religion I mention is when I talk about why evolution is true and creationism is wrong, which you have to do when you talk about the facts of evolution. You have to oppose them to the most widespread alternative theory, which is creationism. So you have to say, well, there's no evidence for great flood, and we see these transitional forms. You know, the Earth is older than 6,000 years. Some people say even that's going too far and dismissing religion. But in my view, you teach science as science is best received by the community at the time, and stay away from theology or any entanglement with religion or you know, atheism.
Yeah. And it, this seems to be, I recently saw that you, or heard that you taught a creation and evolution, I don't know if it was a whole class or a lecture when you
were... It was a class.
At Maryland?
Yeah.
Right. And that was pre-tenure for you? Is that right?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. So I wonder what motivated you to start doing that. Was that your first sort of public, you know...
Yeah, I guess you could call it my incursion into the controversy. When I taught at Maryland, and I taught there for 4.5 years until I got tenure, my classroom was located right above a big plaza in front of the building, and outside in the plaza very frequently there would be a creationist preacher on a soapbox who would be haranguing against evolution. And I'd stop and listen to the guy, and the students would heckle him. He was religious, of course, and, you know, it was then I started to realize this stuff. I mean, I knew creationism existed, but I hadn't really seen it in my environment, and then I realized that this guy was, you know, saying a lot of nonsense, and he had some adherents. And so it was, I guess, about that time that scientific creationism started to make its way into the public eye. That was in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And Henry Morris's book, you know, was out. So I decided, you know, why not let the students... I don't think this course was a biology course. I think it was some kind of, you know, biology and society course, something like that. But I said, well, why don't I just teach both evolution and creationism and let the students make up their own mind. And so that's what I did. You know, I'd go in and lecture on Monday as an evolutionist, talk about one topic like radiometric dating or the fossil record. And then on Wednesday, I'd come in as a creationist. And I knew the literature very extensively then because I read all their stuff. And so I'd say, you know, everything that guy told you on Monday was junk. You know, the fossil record doesn't show evolution for reasons X, Y, and Z. Radiometric dating is all wrong because, you know, the usual arguments. Carbon-14 dating has been shown to be wrong. There's no way of testing it. We could have had some of the, you know, elements present when the rocks were formed. And the students would be deeply confused.
Yeah.
They hadn't heard anything like that before. And I did it with conviction. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I was trying not to bias them one way or the other. And then on Friday, we'd sit down as a group and just discuss those issues. And again, I try not to push them towards one way or the other. And at the end, all the people that started off as evolutionists were still evolutionists. And about half the students that started off as creationists had become, you know, or even more had become advocates of evolution. So, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you teach that class beyond Maryland? Or would you do it differently if you...
Well, the arguments have changed, of course.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Scientific creationism is, for one thing, you know, you couldn't, yeah, the arguments have changed. We have intelligent design now. We have the fine-tuning argument, things that weren't around then. So you'd have to teach it in a different way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to teach it again. There's two problems with that. First of all, I have to bone up on all this stuff.
Yeah.
I don't spend a great deal of time reading all the new creationist arguments. I mean, they tend to be the same anyway. But second of all, this is the University of Chicago.
Yeah.
And there's that many students that are really creationist that I can put my finger on. So I don't know what the point would be in trying to present them with a side that they don't believe in anyway.
Yeah.
Unless I want to convince them of creation.
Yeah. Was your first time publicly writing about this that I think you had a 1990s six, maybe, review of Darwin's Black Box in Nature? Was that the first time you publicly sort of
started
taking this stuff on?
Doing public writing about it. You're talking about creationism by itself?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was probably the first time I had gone after it, although I'd have to look at my CV.
Yeah.
The first really large article I wrote on it was a New Republic article, which was, I think, about 5,000 words. And it started off as a review of Pandas and People, which is a intelligent design book.
Yeah.
And then it grew into a general critique of the intelligent design movement, both scientific and sociological.
Yeah.
And so that sort of got me deeply enmeshed in this whole thing. So
I wonder from the perspective of a sort of research biologist, putting out work that's sort of aimed towards the populace, the popular writing through your website, through books, through the articles you do in the New Republic.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you think about sort of impact or societal impact or sort of long lastingness of the two sort of modes of output that you've had, major modes. So you've written a book about speciation and you've written, 100+ articles about, peer-reviewed articles about mm-hmm. Drosophila genetics and speciation. Do you think one for you will sort of last longer or have more impact? Like, do you ever think about that?
That's a hard question because the way science impacts the future is different from the way popular science does. So the impact on science, I mean, and we have to get used to this as scientists, is that everything that you discover is eventually going to be outmoded. It's going to be superseded. I mean, already the genetic work I did on speciation using very crude tools at the beginning of my career has been refined to the point where it's no longer useful. You can use molecular markers now, and the story is much more clean and much more extensive. But, they wouldn't have done that if it hadn't been for me.
Right, so, exactly, yeah.
So, if you put a few bricks, I mean, I'm not a paradigm builder. I'm basically a brick in the wall type of guy. You know, your contribution is twofold. Well, your contribution is to inspire others to build on your work and try to turn them in a certain direction, which is what I tried to do with my book, Speciation. Try to show people that here's a whole area of biology that people have not really spent a lot of time on. Darwin, despite the title of his book, didn't make any inroads on it. The problem has been raised in the modern synthesis, but again, there's not much work on the genetic changes that occur to make new species. I mean, it's an open field.
Yeah.
And that's why I got into it and published a lot on it. And that's why I wrote the book, basically, to show people, well, here's where we are, here's where the questions need to be answered. And actually, I'm a lot prouder of my book than I am of the research that I've done.
Really?
But I couldn't have written that. I mean, actually, writing that book is probably, in terms of intellectual accomplishments, speciation, I think, is probably the thing that I'm most proud of. It took 6 years to write. I mean, Alan Orr was a co-author, but I really like it. I mean, I couldn't have written that book without having done the research.
Yeah, of course, right? Of course.
But if there is a contribution that will last longer than my technical accomplishments in finding out stuff, it would be that book.
Yeah.
Which I think, I'm not trying to be immodest, but I think it has had an influence in the nature and direction of research in the field. Of course, the reason one does science isn't just to, build up the body of knowledge for other people so that in the future we have a huge understanding of speciation. It's also because of just the pleasure of finding things out, as Feynman called it.
Yeah, yeah.
If you didn't have that moment of discovery, those aha moments, seeing something that nobody had ever seen before, it wouldn't be so much fun. So that's one of the strong motivations to do it. So in terms of, how the popular stuff will last, hard to tell. I know I've made converts in terms of making people accept evolution or impelling them or compelling them or urging them to accept evolution when they haven't before, but there's only so much one can do in a country where religion prevents them from doing that. I just find it pleasurable to do that, and I like to educate people. It's sort of an extension of my job as a teacher, and it's fun. I mean, writing and speaking in a popular way is a challenge for somebody that's sequestered in the lab and used to writing academic papers. And if there's one thing that sort of characterizes my purpose or my motivation, it's that I need challenges. So,
yeah.
And popular writing and speaking is an immense challenge. It's one, in fact, that you can never fully. I mean, I think now, and I'm going to retire in about a year and a half, I've pretty much run my course as a research scientist. It was fun. It was a good run. But the challenge is not so great as it used to be. I know how to write papers. I know how to, write books, scientific books. I know how to write grants. I know how to teach. I know how to review things. And so a lot of the challenge is gone. What remains is those aha moments, but those aren't enough to sustain me. So, but popular writing and popular speaking and going on to areas like religion, that's a challenge I think will carry me through to the grave. simply because you can always get better and better and better at writing. You're never, I'll never be as good as Richard Dawkins, but there's the model.
Yeah. Sure.
I can asymptotically approach the quality of his writing, probably never the quality of his thought, but you can always get better.
And yeah.
That's an immense challenge.
I listened to an interview with Lewington, your PhD advisor, mm-hmm. and, the interviewer was asking him sort of, about his sort of work in popular writing and sort of social commentary and how, and then his response to that was he felt, being a research biologist sort of gives one credibility to make statements about certain things. And that was very important to him about having the research background mm-hmm. and credibility and sort of what he puts out to the public. Like, I'm not just anybody, like, these are informed opinions because this is my profession. And that, I think, was an important part to him. And it seemed like he sort of saw that as sort of, sort of a responsibility almost of being a research biologist, especially in his position at Harvard. I wonder if you agree with that, if you feel the same way. I mean, how much his sort of approach to that influenced you?
Yeah, marginally, I suppose Dick's popularization activities did influence mine. He was a good role model for that. And I remember the first thing I wrote that wasn't real science, it was a book review that I wrote as like a second year grad student in his lab, because I could see him doing this. And of course, he's a terrific writer himself. I remember him telling me something very similar to what he told you, which was, you know, Jerry, you gotta keep up your research career, because without that research, you're not going to have any credibility for the other stuff that you say. And I remember him saying, you know, if I couldn't look at myself in the mirror shaving each day and think that I had any credibility on any issues unless I had this credibility as a research scientist. But he meant it in a different way that I would construe it. What he meant was you have to keep up an active research career going if you're going to have credibility for your popular writing. And A, I don't believe that's true. I mean, my research career now is waning, and I think I've already established my credibility. I don't think you have to establish it on an ongoing basis. Second of all, a lot of what Dick wrote about didn't have much to do with evolutionary biology.
Yeah.
You know, it was sociology, it was other kinds of stuff, and his credibility rested not so much on his research accomplishments as on his intellectual acumen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yeah, when I pronounce on evolution, I like to have the under my belt the fact that I'm a trained evolutionary biologist and I have a lifetime of doing that. And I think, you know, that makes people listen to me more. But, you know, if a lay person told me something about evolution, and they do all the time on my website,
yeah, yeah,
that I don't know, I'm not going to discount that because they don't have a PhD.
Right.
I mean, science is something that a lot of people can do. And what's really counts in science is the quality of thought and the ideas, not so much the fact that you have a long and distinguished career, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's sort of backtrack and go into your sort of scientific upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
You went to college at the College of William & Mary, and you got involved with the Drosophila genetics lab pretty quickly, it seems like, mm-hmm. and had a... From all things that I can tell, a pretty amazing mentor as an undergrad, and Bruce Grant.
Yes.
And that he not only, because, I mean, William & Mary isn't a research university. It's
No, it isn't.
Yeah.
It's getting more that way, but all liberal arts schools are, because that's where money comes from. But yeah, at the time, it was a teaching school.
Yeah. And so, but he not only mentored you in research, he mentored people who would become your PhD students to have highly successful careers, Mohamed Noor and Alan Orr.
And a lot of other scientists like Walt Eanes at Stony Brook, Greg Ray at Duke. I mean, you know, he's got a lot of them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a pretty amazing record for a liberal arts teacher. So
what was his gift of mentorship, and sort of how did that come out to play in sort of how you interacted with him and how he sort of treated you as an interested undergrad getting involved in research? How did that play out?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought of it. I suppose it would be in a couple of different ways. First of all, he was informal and treated you as an equal or a colleague and not as a student. So that carries over in how you treat your own students, obviously. He established a pattern, which was reinforced by Lewontin, that the mentor does not take credit for your work. So my very first paper, which I think was published in Genetics, my first real paper, his name is not on it. So he wouldn't have that, and neither would Dick. And, of course, that sets up a pattern, which so I don't put my name on my students' papers either, unless I truly collaborate with them. The main reason, so that's one reason why Bruce was such a great mentor. He was, you know, he thought of you as a colleague and as a friend and as somebody to interact with a lot. So you set up headquarters in his lab as an undergraduate, which is a rare thing to do. And he would be there all the time, inspiring you to do your research. Second of all, he's just very enthusiastic. I mean, if there was a human equivalent of a puppy dog, I mean, in a good way, and the fact that he was always very excited and enthusiastic about science, that was him. And that made you enthusiastic about science. It was infectious. He did what he could to move careers forward here, to, you know, talk to you about where you want to go to school, and here's good places to go, here's grants you can apply for, things like that. So, you know, all that, I think, it's certainly no coincidence that, you know, he produced a number of people that are well-known professional evolutionary biologists. It has to do with his love of the field, his ability to convey that to his students.
Yeah, because I know, I've heard that you went into college sort of with the idea that you want to be a marine biologist, which a lot of us have. It's like just a common syndrome.
Yep.
Everybody wants to study dolphins and whales.
And be on ships and watch whales,
Yeah. So I wonder, when you got into his lab and started working with Gestapo was probably like the last thing on your list of things that cool biologists probably want to study. So I wonder what you found that sort of equaled the excitement that you thought was going to be found in marine biology.
Yeah, well, I never got a chance to be a marine biologist.
Yeah.
So it was always a dream.
What excited? What like sort of went to that same desire, you think?
Well, let me add that before I went into Bruce Grant's lab, which I guess was my second year of college, what really got me started in evolution was another inspirational teacher, Jack Brooks. His real name was Garnett R. Brooks, but everybody called him Jack. And he taught freshman biology, and he happened to be an evolutionary biologist who worked on reptiles, and he was extremely enthusiastic. I mean, basically, that's what got me started, because the very first day of my first day of college, which is 8 a.m. on a Monday, the first day I got there, we had Bio 1 with Jack Brooks, and he started off teaching about evolution, and it was just, he was a very charismatic person. Undergraduates were drawn to him. He was, you know, enthusiastic. He was sort of a, what's the name of that archaeologist in the movies? You know,
Indiana Jones.
Indiana. He's like an Indiana Jones guy. He wore a hat. He went out and looked at reptiles, but he also knew a lot about evolution.
Yeah.
And then he got me into Bruce Grant's class. I wasn't supposed to take genetics.
Yeah.
Until I was a sophomore, but he talked Bruce into taking me as a freshman, and so we started working with flies. And you know, I can still remember the moment that would formally classify me as the beginning of my career, and that's when we were given an unknown mutation to identify. Mm-hmm. So we have a vial of flies, and they have white eyes, and we're supposed to figure out, okay, what is this mutation? And then we have a vial of wild-type flies with red eyes, and we're supposed to do crosses to figure it out. Well, we knew some Mendelian genetics by then, so we knew how to make crosses and stuff, and had a husband, Drosophila. So I crossed the white-eyed flies to the red-eyed flies, and in the first generation, you get all red-eyed flies. So you figure, okay, it's a single recessive gene for white eyes, which it is classically, except that it's on the X chromosome. So all the flies in this had red eyes, no matter which direction you made the cross. So although it might have been recessive, it wasn't on the X chromosome. If it was an X chromosome gene, if you crossed white-eyed females to red-eyed males, all the males would be white-eyed, all the females would be red-eyed. And they weren't that way. So already it was a mystery, because you could see, well, classical white eyes is a single gene. So then you cross the first generation of flies together, and I remember this very clearly. You get four colors of eyes, or I got four colors of eyes. So you get the regular dull red eyes, you get white eyes, but then you get very bright orangish red eyes, and then you get brown eyes. So you get four colors. out of two. And I couldn't figure out, well, how does that happen? And then I remember I was taking swimming class then, because in those days gym was required. I was sitting by the side of the pool waiting for my turn for my swimming test and trying desperately to figure out how you can get four colors of eyes out of two. And all of a sudden it hit me that there's got to be two genes involved in this eye color. One of them makes the red pigment, one of them makes the brown pigment. When you have them together, you get the normal eyes. If you take one away, you either get bright red pigment or brown pigment. If you take them both away, you don't get any pigments. You get white eyes. So, you know, that was my hypothesis, and I went back to the lab, and then you can do crosses to test this, of course. Sure enough, there was two genes. And then you figure out, well, they're not independently assorting because the colors don't come out in the ratio of, you know, that you should get. And then, so they're linked. They're on the same chromosome, these two genes. Which chromosome are they on? And you can do crosses to test that. And the results were just so clean. You know, it was two genes. I gave them abnormal names. I didn't know what they were. It turned out that they were cinnabar and brown, which are classical Drosophila genes. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that. I had to work it all out from scratch. And the results were so clean. I knew that there were two genes. I could prove that. I could prove which chromosome they were on and how far they were apart. And it was a revelation. You know, there was no evolution in that. It was just pure genetics. But, you know, if there's anything that's characterized my work, and I think also the work of at least some of my students, like Alan, it's this desire to get clean results that aren't ambiguous. That's inherent in Mendelian genetics. And you can use that kind of tool then to find the genes that are responsible for creating reproductive isolation. So Bruce was interested in speciation as well. His own thesis was on that. And so I was able to use the tools that I had acquired in elementary genetics to apply to a problem of evolutionary biology. And that's, you know, where all this work came from.
So. Yeah, yeah. And then when you were done at William & Mary, you got into Rockefeller University, is that right?
To work with Dobzhansky. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. How did you establish, did Bruce Grant know Dobzhansky, or sort of introduce yourself to him?
You don't even apply to work with a guy at Rockefeller. What happens is you apply to the school.
Okay.
And then you're interviewed by a committee of four people. You know, I guess I met Dobzhansky during my interview very briefly, but, you know, but the people that interviewed me were like Ed E. Tatum of Beadle and Tatum, H. Keffer Hartline, who had won the Nobel Prize for work on vision. I mean, there were four, Norton Zender, another very famous, molecular. So, you know.
But you wanted to work with Dobzhansky. That was the whole reason for you going to Rockefeller?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to, because he was, you know, Mr. Speciation and Mr. Evolution at the time.
Yeah.
So I got in, they deliberately keep you away from the person you want to work with. I don't know what the rationale is for that, but I got in and went there to work with him. And then I got drafted as a conscientious objector. So I had to actually drop out of that school for 13 months. I had been drafted illegally, it turned out, but I didn't find that out until later. And so I continued to live at the university, but I couldn't do any science. I worked in a hospital as a medical technician for 13 months. And by the time I got out, which I did by filing a court case against the government for being drafted illegally, Dobzhansky had already decided to move from Rockefeller to Davis.
Yeah.
And so we're going to retirement. And so that left me with the conundrum, okay, what am I going to do now?
Did you not interact with him when you were there?
Not really. I mean, I had a 9-to-5 job, and, you know, I would drop by the lab occasionally. I was, you know, I would talk to some of his students, like Jeff Powell and stuff, but, you know, I was basically working a job and had no time to do science and stuff, so.
Yeah. But throughout the 13 months of service at this hotel or hospital, yeah. You still maintained, obviously, an interest in science. Like, that didn't wane.
No, I kept reading the journals, and I had a coterie of, I still lived in the dorm, so I would interact with my buddies. We had three good buddies in graduate school there, and one of them was an ecologist. The other two were molecular biologists. So, you know, I kept my hand in the science, although not so much in evolution, but I still subscribed to evolution and genetics and read those journals every month. So, you know, I was up to speed pretty much. I should add that before I got into Rockefeller, I had also applied to the University of Chicago here.
Oh, really?
In fact, to Lewontin's lab, which is right across the hall there. And and gotten in there as well.
Oh, you had gotten in.
I'd gotten in, but I decided to go to Rockefeller instead.
So how does E.O. Wilson play into you getting into Harvard as a grad student?
That's a funny story, you know. After I, Dubchansky, I got out of my hospital job. I needed to find a place to go to graduate school. Dubchansky had left Rockefeller to go to Davis. I didn't particularly want to go to Davis, and he had gone into sort of semi-retirement and was getting older anyway. So I said, okay, I'll go to the University of Chicago, because I had been accepted there, and they, you know, so, and plus I had I had an NSF pre-doctoral fellowship.
Yeah.
So I had my own money for like 3 or 4 years of graduate school, which makes it a lot easier to get in.
Sure.
Because they don't have to pay for you. So, you know, I'd been accepted here, and I was going to work with Lewontin. And so I called up Lewontin and said, you know, I got in here a couple of years ago. I'd like to come back and work for you. You know, would you take me as a student? He said, oh, you know, I'm sorry. I'm moving to Harvard. And I didn't know that because, you know, I didn't have any contact with him in the meantime. And I said, well, can I go work with you at Harvard? And he said, well, you know, you really can't because you'd have to get into Harvard because I've already negotiated to take my current crop of students with me from Chicago to Harvard. I haven't negotiated for somebody I don't even know you. So you have to get into Harvard, you know. And so I had to get into Harvard and I had like a week to do it. It was, you know, I was desperate. So I flew up to Harvard with my resume, some of the papers I'd published. And I just knocked on Ed Wilson's door cold at like 9 a.m. And, you know, I introduced myself and I said, you know, this is my dilemma. I'm a student. I really want to work here. I want to work with Dick Lewontin, but I need to get into Harvard. And I hadn't applied to Harvard. And the admissions committee was going to meet in like 2 or 3 days. So, but Wilson was so nice. He took me into his office. He talked to me. He looked at my materials. He realized that I was no slouch. You know, I had published, several papers before, as an undergraduate.
Yeah.
I was a decent prospect. Plus, I had my own money. So he just got on the phone and started making calls to other professors and setting up appointments for me. So for the rest of the day, I went from one professor to another, telling them who I was and introducing myself. And at the end of the day, they let me apply, which meant they put me in the basement of the Museum of Comparative Zoology with a typewriter and an application. I remember I was sitting in this dark room full of specimens with this typewriter and this 4-page application. And then I cut myself on the typewriter keys trying to unjam them. So I got blood all over my application Harvard. It was just a big mess. But sure enough, you know, I applied, and about several days after that, I got notice that they let me in. And it was all due to Wilson, his kindness and his willingness to help somebody out who looked like they might be a good prospect.
That's insane.
Yeah,
that's crazy that you just flew there on a whim, just knock on his door.
Yeah.
Can I have an interview right now?
Yeah. I mean, my life would have been completely different if he had just not been there, if he had not been interested, you know, if he hadn't pushed me forward. It's sort of ironic that he and Lewontin became such bitter enemies when I was there.
Yeah.
At Harvard. But I could never dislike Ed.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, he's a really nice guy. And second of all, he did this, you know, really nice thing for me when I was a graduate student. So.
And you were his TA too, weren't you?
Yeah, I taught two years of Bio 1 for him, which was introductory biology, which he taught very well. So, I mean, it gave me a bit of cognitive dissonance when Dick and Ed were at each other's throats. And believe me, it was not a pleasant time to be in the museum. They were just one floor apart. And to get into the elevator with Lewontin, and then Ed walked in, and there'd be this icy silence as the elevator went up 3 floors.
Oh, jeez.
It was just palpable tension. You know, in many ways, I sympathize with Dick's views of sociobiology, that it was a bit too ambitious and stuff.
Yeah.
Although I never agreed with him that it was some kind of sexist political machination to take over the world, because Ed just wasn't like that. Maybe other people had their ideologies that played into that, but not Wilson. So there's a bit of cognitive dissonance, but I was, you know, I managed to keep my, you know, friendship with Wilson and his lab, because several of my best friends were students, and you know, be integrated into the Lunatone Lab at the same time. So I survived. So.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That was the time.
That was a crazy time at Harvard.
It was. That was when they dumped water on Ed's head at the meeting, and, you know, the science for the people thing. I mean,
you weren't part of the sociobiology reading group.
No, I wasn't.
Like, but, study group,
you know,
or
Dick Levins was on the same floor as Lunatone, and he had a very political lab that was very uncomfortable for a lot of us because he ran that lab like a communist collective. And once every week, they would all go into a room and they would have these incrimination sessions like they did during the Cultural Revolution, where one person would be singled out to be accused for political malfeasance or poor understanding. And I remember people coming out of those meetings crying and stuff, you know. Levins was very, very political. And, you know, it was sort of heartbreaking to see this kind of stuff happen.
Yeah. Wow. Jeez.
Yeah, I didn't have much to do with that end of the business. Yeah. Dick Levins and Dick Lunatone were very close colleagues. I mean, Levins was here.
They wrote a book together.
Yeah, they did. And they had been colleagues in Chicago. And Dick was responsible for bringing Levins to Harvard in the School of Public Health. So, he had an office on our floor, just at the end of the hall where his students sat. So there was all this political stuff going on. We tried to ignore it. I just wanted to learn biology and genetics. So
One name that didn't come up when you were talking is Gould.
Yeah.
Did you take any classes from Gould?
I took one class that was taught by him in Lewinton. It was sort of a
really
advanced evolution class. That was very strange because here we have two like rhinoceri in the same room competing for territories. I remember, you know, that Dick was lecturing one day, and he sang a snatch of opera. And of course, Gould couldn't let that go by because he was a singer in the St. Cecilia Chorus. So he started singing too. And these two guys were like singing each other, showing off how much they knew about opera. It was like sort of two male lions and urinating in their territories.
That's amazing. Wow. Yeah,
it was fun because those guys were really smart.
Yeah, of course.
Gould was on my committee, my thesis committee, but he was always an arrogant guy, always very full of himself. And when he started writing about punctuated equilibrium and I started arguing with him about that, he didn't like me so much.
Yeah.
That's when he called me a hidebound gradualist. I'll never forget that. We invited him up to the lab to discuss punctuated equilibrium, and when it became clear to him that we didn't really buy the theory, at least in terms of a mechanistic theory of how evolution works, he got angry and started yelling. I mean, Gould was not really a very nice person. Even Lewinton will admit that. I interviewed Dick about this a couple years ago, which I hope to publish someday. And, you know, it's all public. And he agreed with me that, you know, Gould was not a nice human being. He was a very smart human being, a very eloquent human being.
Right.
But not a very nice human being.
Right.
So, you know, my experience with him was, you know, limited.
Right. Did you admire his writing at the time?
Yeah, and I still do, although I like his earlier writings better,
course,
before he became full of himself, and they became so rococo with sentences within sentences. And then he came out with that god-awful accommodations book, Rocks of Ages, which, you know. But I still, I mean, I have his books up there on the shelf, and I will still turn to them occasionally.
Yeah.
His earliest books, The Flamingo Smile, his essays in natural history are very good. I still like The Mismeasure of Man, although it's been criticized.
Yeah.
I think the criticism has been rescinded now, but it is a magnificent and well-written book on the history of science. So, yeah, I mean, he's just one of those guys that's, you know, you have to admire because they're smart and they write well, but on the other hand, they aren't really nice human beings, and you just, you know, this is a common situation in science. So
yeah.
It's one you have to learn to live with. So.
Sure. And then after Harvard, you went on to work with another Dobzhansky student, right? Timothy Prout?
Tim Prout, yeah.
As a postdoc at
He was
Davis.
Actually Lewinton's office mate in graduate school. So they were both Dobzhansky students.
At the same time.
Yeah, although Tim was like 6 years older than Dick, but Tim had been in World War II, so he had his graduate school was interrupted while he was fighting in Italy. And then, so he was older than Dick.
Yeah.
But, you know, I went to Davis to work with.
So I feel like you still got your Dobzhansky experience through Lewinton and through.
Yeah, because both Tim and Dick were deeply influenced by Dobzhansky. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Dick, of course, pointed out a lot of the problems with Dobzhansky's work in this collected papers, the genetics and natural populations, but he always admired Dobzhansky for several things. First of all, Dobzhansky worked in the lab until the day he died, practically. When I met him in Davis, and when I saw him in Rockefeller, he was sitting, you know, in his office looking at chromosome slides. That's what he did. He read inversion frequencies, and that's what he did. He did science. Dobzhansky did not put his name on all of the papers that came out of his lab. And you can find papers coming out of Dobzhansky's lab that are authored just by Boris Spassky or Pavlovsky. Those were his technicians. Mm-hmm. And yet, he would let them publish papers. He would write the papers. He would tell them what to do. He would do a lot of the readings. But because he felt like he did not do sufficient labor on the paper, they would be the only authors. And this sort of authorship thing, which I consider quite important in the field, to not put your name on every paper that comes out of your laboratory, that was inculcated into both Tim and Dick by Dobzhansky. And they both perpetuated this culture, and I've perpetuated this culture. They got it from Dobzhansky. Dobzhansky got it from Thomas Hunt Morgan. So this sort of tradition of not, you know, bullying your way into gratuitous publication started at the very beginning of genetics with T.H. Morgan, who had a big lab full of Bridges and Serva and Muller and even Dobzhansky and stuff. So,
has that ever caused you problems? Have you ever had to defend your stance into like a tenure committee or sort of, because that's not like now, that's not a normal stance.
Let me say first that I think it should be a normal stance.
Yeah.
If you're not really a scientist, if you just sit in your office and tell people what to do and don't work in the lab, this is a personal feeling, but it's just led to this gratuitous multiple authorship where a professor will have dozens of postdocs in his or her lab and put his or her name on all their papers. And frequently you get your name on a paper when you hardly do anything at all. Even if you give somebody like a strain of flies that you've created, you want credit for that. I think that's a really bad thing for the field. I think it's demoralizing for the students who see, because if you publish a paper with a famous mentor, the person gets credit for is your mentor, not you.
Right.
And Marty Kreitman's, who's here down on the first floor, was one in my lab, and he was the first person to do a population genetic analysis of DNA sequences, a paper that was published in Nature, with Marty as the sole author. Dick would not put his name on that paper, even though he had a big hand in inspiring the research.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, even though Dick's name wasn't on the paper, people will still talk to him, you know, I really like that paper that you wrote with Kreitman. Marty doesn't get, he still has to share credit with Dick, even though Dick's name wasn't even on the paper. So this is called the Matthew effect, and there's a paper in Science on that from the book of Matthew where it says, to he that hath it shall be given. So, you know, so I'm just saying all this because I don't like this culture.
Yeah.
And I don't like it being promulgated. I think it's bad for the student. It's good for the professor because you can have all these gratuitous authorships. In terms of how I suffered from it, I didn't. And the reason I didn't was because I always did my own research in the lab. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, up until a year before I decided to retire, I was sitting out in the lab several times. That's another thing that I like to do, because you interact with your students much more deeply when you're sitting across the lab bench from them than when they have to come to you in your office and ask advice. You're constantly having conversations in the bench. You learn a lot of science. They learn a lot of science. You forge bonds. You design projects that way. And so I had sufficient papers. Mm-hmm. I mean, my output is not huge by the standards of, you know, a decent scientist. I think I have like 115 papers, which, you know, I mean, 100 was my goal when I started out, and it still seems impossibly a lot to me. But there are people with 400 or 500 papers now, and they do that by putting their names on other people's papers. But, you know, I had enough, and they were sufficiently good that I never really suffered. Plus, I had
You have other intellectual contributions.
Well, the main one, of course, for universities is that I had the same grant for 30 years. So I was never for a second without money, and that matters a lot to them. It shouldn't be that way, but that's the way it is.
Yeah.
Now, basically, the thing that you need to advance in modern-day academia are papers and grants. The other stuff I was doing, the popular stuff, or quality of teaching, that really doesn't matter much in a research-oriented university.
Do you think it should?
Yeah, certainly it should. Well, teaching should certainly matter. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no real impetus at universities that are research universities, certainly not here very much, to be a good teacher. I mean, you can be a really sucky teacher here and still get by, and you can get crappy evaluations, but what are they going to do? You know, if you're pulling in the grants and writing papers, that's what's important to them.
Yeah.
So really, to want to teach well, you have to want it on your own. There's no pressure to do that.
Yeah.
I think there should be that kind of pressure, not only because it's good for the students, but because it's good for you. One thing I've discovered, it's a bromide, but it's true, is you cannot really say you understand something unless you can explain it to a graduate student or even an undergraduate student.
Mm-hmm.
So teaching, although it doesn't give you a lot of ideas for research, it certainly helps you clarify your thinking and be able to write properly. In terms of the other stuff like writing my website or doing popular stuff, you don't get any credit for that. I don't even put that on my... I mean, I have a section of my CV for popular writings. I don't even mention that, you know, I spend several hours a day on my doing a website.
Yeah.
It wouldn't help me or anything like that. So...
I don't know. I mean, you have a huge impact on the field by doing that.
Yeah, but, you know, universities have not yet come around to seeing, you know, blogging as any kind of form of professional contribution. I think it probably should be taken into account. I don't feel like I've been, you know, unfairly passed over because what I do, blogging has been overlooked because I consider it a hobby, not part of my professional. I do it usually between 6 and 8 a.m., and that's before work hours start and stuff. Someday universities are going to start taking this into account, I think, because it's become such a, you know, common way for scientists to communicate.
Yeah.
And certainly those people who write blogs that are mostly about science, and mine isn't, you know, maybe 50%, maybe less science, but those people that devote their entire websites, like John Losos, to promulgating the findings of science should get some credit for that.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay, I've got one more before we go. I think I've heard you say this, that you think sort of the impact, the cultural impact of studying evolution sort in sort of an applied way, like its benefits to medicine, for instance, mm-hmm. are sort of overemphasized. And that's sort of not the true, not the most maybe valuable or important impact of learning about evolution for society at large, and sort of the impact of what you do as a research scientist. Mm-hmm. So I wonder what the, in your view, what the main, you know, why study it?
Why study evolution?
What do you think is the most sort of cultural value, and what does that tell us about
yourself?
Yeah,
ourselves? So why would the average person want to learn about evolution? What would they gain from it?
Yeah.
I've changed my mind a little bit about the practical benefits of evolution. Largely persuaded by, well, not completely.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Dave Hillis, who is incensed about my blog post I wrote saying, you know, evolution doesn't have many practical benefits, sent me a long list of how it's been used, and it was sufficiently detailed that I realized that there are practical benefits. Although a lot of those benefits we've had before Darwin came along, like animal breeding and plant breeding and figuring out how vaccines work. You can do most of that stuff without a really strong technical knowledge of evolutionary biology.
Yeah.
So I still feel that the main benefit of evolution to the average person is not that it improves their lives in a tangible way. It doesn't make them, you know, wealthier. It doesn't necessarily make them healthier. You want to learn about evolution because it's for two reasons. First of all, it's true.
Yeah.
But mostly because it's the true story of how we got here. I mean, if you want to know about origins, and of course religious people study the Bible for that, but that's a myth as far as I'm concerned, that the true theory of origins is the story of evolution. And it's a pretty amazing thing to contemplate. First of all, that you and I sitting here is extremely complex organisms having a linguistic interaction. We can understand each other. And meanwhile, all this stuff is going on in our bodies. It's extraordinarily complicated. We're synthesizing DNA. Our physiology is working. That all that came from the materials, inorganic materials in the earth through the process of evolution. That's a pretty amazing thing to contemplate. And I wish more people would realize how amazing that really is. Plus the fact that we're related to everything else. I mean, you know, that we share not only genes, but traits with other species. And, you know, we're first cousins to chimpanzees, second cousins to orangutans and things like that. It's just, you know, an amazing story. The fact that such a complex, well, Darwin summarized it in the last paragraph of The Origin. The tangled bank, when you contemplate all this amazing diversity of life before you and realize that it just came from this simple materialistic process of evolution as an, you know, almost an inevitable result, is a pretty astounding thing. So, you know, so the same kind of benefits you get from studying evolution are the benefits you get from learning about cosmology and the Big Bang and about supernovas and about black holes. I mean, really, how does that stuff improve the life of the average person? It doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, if we didn't know anything about black holes, we'd be just as good off as we are today. The reason we want to learn about it is because it's like art, sort of, but it's real. It's true. To think of that there are such things as quantum entanglement, which defies the imagination. We don't even understand how things like that can work, or that there are things like black holes that are so gravitationally powerful that even light cannot escape from them. It's just astounding. So it's like it's like having this big book of, you know, amazing stories, but it's a book of true stories. And to a scientist, and I think to a lot of lay people, because certainly Richard Dawkins, who has made his living describing this, has sold quite well.
Yeah.
There's a great, well, an appetite for wonder, which is what he's called this autobiography there.
Right.
So I think the main reason people want to, or should be learning about evolution is because it's deeply satisfying to their appetite for wonder. It's like a big steak as opposed to the Bible, which is like cotton candy.
Yeah, yeah.
It satisfies something, but not very deeply, and then you get hungry again. So.
Yeah, I mean, the appetite for wonder seems to be the major motivating factor for research scientists across the board. But how...
Yeah. Even those whose research has practical benefits are still... I mean, H.L. Mencken described that, I think. He was doing metaphors of various professions.
Yeah.
And the one of the scientists was a dog sniffing endlessly at a series of rat holes. And that's really what we're doing. I mean, we're sniffing a lot of holes. A lot of them are empty, but there's rats in some of them. When you find one, you get really excited. And in science, it's even better because the rats that we find are rats that nobody has ever known about before. So
you know,
that's the kind of wonder that satisfied. And any scientist that really isn't enjoying what he or she does is in the wrong business. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the pay is okay, but it's, you know, anybody that can get a job at the University of Chicago could have been a surgeon and making $750,000 a year.
Yeah.
And getting a lot more respect and stuff. Now, you do it because it's fun. And the greatest reward is, I think, Feynman, you know, characterized it. I mentioned this before, the pleasure of finding things out. It really is sort of a thrill that most people do not get in their lives, to see something that nobody has ever known before them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to, you know, that's deeply, deeply satisfying. But then you share that with somebody else. You have to share, or it's no fun.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that is, to me, is the big pleasure of being a scientist. So
great. Well, thanks for talking to me. This
sure,
is fantastic.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. You can download this and other podcast episodes at the podcast website, aodpod.com. I'll see you next time.